Hello and welcome to the Viral History Podcast, the place where you can get your history fix in audio form. It's me, Joe Forrester, and Gemma Chandler with you as always. If you want to get in touch, please do so. Twitter is at @viral_history. Instagram is at @viral_history. Facebook and YouTube, you're searching for, you guessed it, Viral History. And if you want to drop us an email, info@viral-history.com. First-born son of a warrior father who defeated the French at Agincourt, Henry VI of the House Lancaster inherited the crown not only of England but also of France at a time when Plantagenet dominance over the Valois dynasty was at its glorious height. And yet, by the time he was done to death in the Tower of London in 1471, France was lost, his throne had been seized by his rival Edward IV of the House of York, and his kingdom had descended into the violent chaos of the Wars of the Roses. Henry VI is perhaps the most troubled of English monarchs, a pious, gentle, well-intentioned man who was plagued by bouts of mental illness. In Shadow King, Lauren Johnson tells his remarkable and sometimes shocking story in a fast-paced and colourful narrative that captures both the poignancy of Henry's life and the tumultuous and bloody nature of the times in which he lived. I'm delighted to say Lauren is with us now.
Hello. That sounds like a good story, doesn't it?
It does.
Probably write a book on
Yeah.
Pre-order it now. Yeah. That's what we say. So that encapsulates it rather nicely, doesn't it? A pious, well-intentioned man who lived in tumultuous times. Can you give us the broader context of the world that Henry is, we're not even born into, thrown into?
Yeah, absolutely. Because Henry becomes King of England and of France before he's even 1 year old.
So he's an
absolute king baby. And like you say, he's thrown into this world, which is essentially a world of warrior lords and warrior kings. His father is Henry V, who's a really famous great flower of chivalry. And Henry VI, there's no way, obviously, he's going to be leading an army in his nappies. So he grows up against this backdrop of constant violence, of fighting for his lands. But he can't do it himself. So he delegates that fighting to other lords around him. Meanwhile, in France, you get the rise of Joan of Arc, who's fighting for the French right to control French lands against this 8-year-old parvenu from England. As the Hundred Years' War goes on, it becomes clear that Henry VI is just, even as he gets to adulthood, not up to the job of fighting the people that the French have in their army.
And do we think that Henry, poor old Henry, was he doomed from the start because of that minority 8-month-old baby?
Well, child kings don't do well, do they? Most of them, it seems, end up having civil wars at some point. The previous child king was Richard II, who was deposed by Henry's own granddad.
Oh, he was a right knob, though, wasn't he?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And that's, I think that's part of the trouble, is I think probably Richard II was in the minds of Henry's counsellors as he's growing up, this sort of person who became a tyrant from childhood. And I think that maybe Henry's counsellors were so concerned with avoiding Henry being in that mould, avoiding him becoming an authoritative, overly powerful presence, that they sort of squished even the slightest bit of authority that Henry had. And that was not much, it must be said. So I think partly it's the minority. I think also partly it's Henry's personality, whether it's out of fear of conflict or the awareness of the terrible bloodshed that's been going on for, I mean, 80 years by the time he's born into it. He's desperate for peace, and that's the thing he wants more than anything. He wants to bring peace. He wants to be the peacemaker that his father couldn't be, because his father dies fighting.
He always comes across to me, not that I know him personally, but he always comes across to me as someone who just didn't really want to be king.
I think perhaps that's the case, but the trouble is in the Middle Ages, there was no choice to kingship. The whole point of it was based on the premise that you were essentially chosen by God, you were anointed, and Henry is the only king in history to be crowned and anointed in England and in France, so double responsibility when he's a child. So I don't think he would even have imagined that he could choose another life. And even with someone like Richard II, he's king from the time he's 10. So he does have other memories of having grown up under a previous king. Henry VI has nothing. He has no concept of what it is to be a king, except what he's read in books, basically, of dead kings from times past. And I think that must have been very confusing for him. And to have, even from, you know, from your earliest memories, essentially, to have
great lords turning to you and saying, oh, and what do you think, my lord king? Will you resolve this very complex dispute between adults? And you'd be sitting there sort of in the middle going, yeah, could they just shake hands and be friends? I mean, that is Henry's solution consistently throughout his life. I don't think he ever really learns to do much more than that.
I mean, he quite literally does ask people to shake hands. He has this love day, is that right, where he asks the kind of opposing nobles to hold hands.
It's really quite charming.
It's sweet.
I was about to say it's the stupidest thing I've ever heard, but okay, it's charming.
It's charming. I mean, essentially, so that's right towards the end, really, of Henry's first reign in the 1450s, by which point there has already been bloodshed. The civil war between York and Lancaster is already underway. And Henry's way to deal with this, he thinks, is to try and bring together these warring sons, in some cases, of murdered fathers, and to have them walk through the streets together, holding hands through the streets of London. And the fact that Henry's own wife, Margaret of Anjou, is holding the hand of Henry's chief rival, Richard, Duke of York, shows just how serious this feud is, because a queen is supposed to be a peacemaker. And yet here's Henry, as king, unable to impose his power on these people. So his only idea is to make them, promise that they'll be friends forever.
And you're right. I mean, I'm judging him by the swashbuckling, bloody standards of the Middle Ages and what you expect from those kind of kings in the Middle Ages. But actually, in terms of someone you'd want to spend a bit of time with, compared to almost any other, apart from maybe Charles II, compared to almost any other king in history.
I wouldn't want to be around Charles II as a woman, just putting it out there.
No, I think you could have a cracking Friday night out with Charles II, but I would definitely want to leave.
Yes, I'd want to be wearing breeches, I think,
around drinking games, I reckon.
But you, these medieval kings, Henry V, so this, I suppose, relentless conquering machine. Edward III, same thing. Edward I, even worse. These aren't guys you'd want to hang out with, but Henry VI is actually kind of a good egg, isn't he?
Yeah, that's how I feel. He's basically the only medieval king I feel I could sit down with and have a nice little chat, and we'd probably have similar ideas. Maybe I wouldn't be quite as religious as he was. Mm. But, we'd have a nice time. And Henry VI, he likes his wife. He's very respectful to her.
Imagine that.
Can you imagine? He actually seems to treat her with a measure of respect. It's astonishing. He doesn't have mistresses. He seems to like his kid as well. And he rewards his friends. There's a really sort of charming side to him, I think. So he remembers even kindnesses that were done to him when he was a child. His governess, who looks after him until he's about 7 years old, a woman called Alice Butler, he remembers her, I mean, pretty much for the rest of his life when he's able to give patronage. He still sends her tons of wine at Christmas when he's an adult.
Great friend.
Yeah, exactly. That's the sort of king you want to be on, have on your corner.
Yeah, it is. But I suppose he's exploited, isn't he? That's the word. And by the measure of the time. So you mentioned people like Richard, Duke of York. There's all these characters in there. Somerset, Suffolk, and none more so than Warwick the Kingmaker. Mm. Gemma and I were talking about him earlier. So Warwick the Kingmaker is a towering figure in English history. Where do all these, horrible blokes fit into it?
Yeah. That's the thing, isn't it? So essentially, Henry VI, because he's grown up surrounded by people who he delegates power to, whether it's to fight or to hold councils, whatever it might be, as he grows up, he wants someone to carry on doing that for him. He wants someone really to be, I think, a bit of a father figure, because he never even met his father, Henry V. And so you get first the Duke of Suffolk, who comes in and acts as a father figure and essentially runs the country, really, through Henry. Then you get, replacing Suffolk, the Duke of Somerset, who is another distant relative of Henry. And then, because, first of all, Suffolk is murdered because of his work with Henry in pushing a peace policy with France, and then Somerset tries to take his place, that's when the Duke of York steps in, because York says, hang on, you've got all these other people trying to be chief advisor, and I'm actually the one who's next in line to the throne. As long as Henry has no child, it'll be me who becomes king next. Why am I not being given a role in government? And York pushes this to such an extent that he starts criticising Henry's government and his courtiers. And even for a king who is very easygoing and hates conflict, which is Henry VI, he can't accept that as a medieval king. He can't have someone who is going to be that outright critical of his regime. And I think that's where the dynamic of York and Lancaster really starts to become an issue, because York wants stuff that Henry is not going to give him. Warwick the Kingmaker, now there is someone who I would not have wanted to meet, but who is completely compelling. He's the spin doctor of the Yorkist regime, basically. He's the one who takes all of York's pent-up anger and aggression and channels it into this kind of emollient political force. So Warwick has managed to tell, like, he tells complete lies about the Lancastrians, about how Margaret and Henry's only son is a changeling and how Margaret's colluding with the French to invade the country. And he does it in such a compelling way that he gets even the Pope's representative on side with him.
Wow.
You think, there is a guy who, you know, he murders his rivals.
He's the spider at the centre of the web, isn't he? Can I just say, I've written down the phrase emollient political force.
That was pretty good, actually.
I'm going to have to Google it.
I'm having that. That's going on my Twitter bio.
Excellent. Oh, you're welcome.
We've talked lots about the, what did you call them? The nasty men of
the horrible
era.
Men.
Horrible blokes.
The horrible blokes. But can we talk a little bit about Henry's main lady, his wife, Margaret of Anjou?
Yes. So
tell me about her.
We remember Margaret, I think, because of Shakespeare. We remember the She-Wolf of France, this very unpleasant sort of grasping figure. And actually, when Margaret comes to England to marry Henry, bearing in mind they are married a year before they even meet each other in a proxy marriage.
Right.
Okay. She's only 15. She arrives in England very unwell, probably because she's so stressed out about marrying this complete stranger. Yeah, exactly. That she has no concept of.
Try and get out of it.
And her and Henry seem to have a very good relationship, actually, for the first 8 years of their marriage. They don't have any children, which is a bit of a curiosity. She is quite young, but 15 is, you know, that's the age of consent for women. It's 12, in fact, for the Middle Ages. And Henry, by that point, he's about 10 years older. So you would have expected them to have children quite early on, and they don't, which is really where sort of the problems with Margaret of Anjou begin, because then people start saying, well, why have we got this French princess married to our king who isn't producing an heir? She gets all of the blame for it. It creates enormous instability, which York can step into. Mm. And as a result, when Margaret finally does become pregnant in 1453, she's already in a really unstable position. And I think that makes sense of why she starts to become quite a defensive character. Because as Henry proves less and less able to govern, and during the course of Margaret's pregnancy, he has a complete mental breakdown, then someone has to fill that gap. Someone has to protect the Lancastrian dynasty. And I think that's what she's doing. I've got a lot of time for Margaret, it must be said.
Me too, yeah.
Should we talk about that mental breakdown? Because the word that is most, or the phrase is most commonly associated with Henry, even in modern parlance with historians, is feeble-minded.
Yes.
Which isn't a very PC term. You certainly wouldn't attribute that to someone today, but it's the old adage, isn't it? Tragedy plus time equals comedy, and people laugh at Henry VI. But are we saying that because he had these moments where he didn't recognize his family, he was incapable of ruling? But are we saying that we feel that it was mental illness?
I think you have to call it mental illness. So in 1453, when Henry's about 31, he has a complete collapse. Essentially, we might today call it a psychotic break. Or a total disassociation, possibly, you could say, in which for 16 months, as far as we're able to work out from the fairly scanty records that are kept during that period, he doesn't recognise anyone. His child is born during the first 3 months of his illness and brought to him, and he doesn't respond to it. Even when the Chancellor dies, and therefore without a king and without a Chancellor, really nothing can happen in the country. So his councillors go to sickly Henry and drag him out, essentially, of his sickbed and go, what do we do? and he still isn't responding to them. And he stays that way for 16 months. So there is I don't think there's any other way to look at it than that is a period of profound mental illness. But that is when he's 31, like I say. Before that, there's sort of accusations of Henry's simplicity is a term that's used a lot, or innocence, which could mean that there's a sort of mental ill health there, but I don't think it does. I don't think there's enough evidence to say that he was unwell before that point. I think he was just avoiding conflict and trying not to cause any trouble around him before that.
These are accusations that are levelled at Edward II as well. Is it a similar... Is it essentially when they say simplicity... It's because they can't understand why someone wouldn't want to take several mistresses and fight the French. They don't understand why somebody wouldn't want to do that.
Well, quite possibly. And Henry does, unlike Edward II, who is a warrior king, he has been to war from his teens. Henry VI never willingly goes to war. He never willingly goes and leads an army, even though there's a couple of times when it seems like it might happen. Mm. I think perhaps it's that. I think also Henry just has a very direct way of imagining things, that he thinks, well, I want a treaty with the French, so when the French ambassadors come, I will go and shake their hands and say hello and be lovely and friendly to them, and I'll tell off my ministers if they don't do the same thing, which diplomatically is the exact opposite of what you should be doing. You're supposed to be cool-headed and, you know, not give way on anything at all. And I think Henry's idea of what diplomacy should be, again, based on what he's reading without ever seeing how it actually works in practice, I think that's what leads to those accusations of simplicity.
Mm. And he was an incredibly pious king, is that correct?
Yes, yeah, that certainly is true. That's something he's remembered as being. And in fact, after he died, he had an entire cult of sainthood based around him. He was kind of a popular saint without never ever being named a saint by the Pope. He had a magic hat, which he had once worn, which apparently, this is incredible, apparently after he died, they kept it, I can't remember where, in a monastery probably, and if you put it on, it cured your headache.
Did it?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Fact.
A bit like those sort of heat patch things.
Yes, exactly.
You get today.
Maybe he had a very cold head.
Yeah, he was an early. He went on the medieval version of Dragon's Den.
Yeah, human migraleave. That was Henry VI. But yeah, during his life, definitely he was certainly a very pious man. He was described by one person when he was only about 16 by an Italian visitor as being more religious than a man of religion. And that tendency does continue. But some of the things that are remembered about him are the result of kind of spin after he is dead and this cult of sanctity has already started. His confessor, who's a man called John Blackman, wrote a biography of him after he was dead, in which he makes quite a few claims of Henry, I mean, performing miracles, literal miracles of multiplying food for his followers and things, which, you know,
He sends people cases of wine and he multiplies food.
Yeah, he's
What's
a great guy. Exactly.
He does sound a bit boring, though, doesn't he, do you think?
I think that's why he hasn't really been remembered so much, because you have all of these massive characters around him. From his childhood, his uncle is an absolute unbearable bully called the Duke of Gloucester, but he's fascinating. And you've got Margaret of Anjou, who's, you know, a woman in a man's world. She's fascinating. The Duke of York, I don't like either particularly, but he is intriguing as a sort of arrogant, ambitious man in that era. Mm. And I think essentially the trouble with Henry is he's the eye of this political storm. Yeah. He's the calm at the centre of it, just trying to get by and just, you know, read a book now and then without someone coming and asking him for something.
So King John, Bad King John, is often named the worst king of England. What would you say to anyone that argued that potentially Henry VI should have that title?
I think there's some similarities between them. Mm. I think that both of them obviously lose bits of France. In Henry's case, most of it.
Just very, bits of. Very careless to lose a bit of France.
They both face military disaster. They both have civil wars against them. But I would argue John is worse because his reign is much shorter. And all of that happens within a much shorter space of time. Whereas actually it takes a really long time for Henry's followers to start deserting him. Even at the point in 1460, by which point Henry's been king for nearly 40 years, when York is saying, no, come on, seriously, I need to be the next king. It's time. Even then, Henry's followers don't agree with York. It's actually Henry himself and his inability to argue, to incite conflict with York that lose him the crown, really.
And York comes to a sticky end, doesn't he, with a paper. He does end up with a crown, but a paper crown.
Yeah, I know, around Christmas time as well. It's sort of oddly fitting.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. I mean, not very festive around the Christmas dinner table. but everybody in this, I mean, one of the reasons that it's something that gets revisited so much in English history, I think the Wars of the Roses, but actually what you've done is focus on Henry, whereas other people don't, is everybody ends up dead.
Yeah, it is 500 years ago. If they weren't dead, it would be astonishing.
Yeah, yeah. Very few people die peacefully in their bed with a smile on their face.
Yes, absolutely. And that's partly why it's so compelling, isn't it? Because it's the highest of high stakes, this period of history. And what I really wanted to do with Henry was to put him back into it, because he gets seen, like you said, he's seen as a weak king or a mad king and nothing else. And the assumption is, oh, well, all of this happened because of those things. Mm. And he was also a human being. He was someone who made the wrong decisions at the wrong time. And that's what's fascinating about him. Someone can be equally as interesting, even if they are as you have said at a glance, a little bit dull.
I like him. I'm with you.
Because of the decisions they make in their life.
And the legacy that he's left behind. I mean, it wasn't all bad. He founded some amazing educational institutions.
Absolutely. So Henry founded Eton College. He founded King's College, Cambridge. And it really is quite amazing, I think, that they are still here to this day, given all of the religious turmoil that happened in between. And they were originally intended to be religious institutions where everyone would pray for Henry and his family after they were long gone. That element, I think, has been dropped. But the education side of it still stands. And that, I think, is quite suitable because Henry, throughout his whole life, he was born on the Feast Day of Children, 6th of December, St. Nick's Day. And he was always concerned that the children around him were protected, that his half-brothers, who were much younger than him, were very well looked after. I wonder if that's because he had such an unstable childhood that he thought, actually, I just want other people not to go through what I went through.
Mm. I just want everyone to get along.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's so wrong with that, guys?
I know. What's not to like about that? And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Eton and King's College, they still hold, I think, like some sort of yearly ceremony, I think,
at the Tower of London, is that right?
Yeah.
Which is where Henry was ultimately murdered. You know, some would say died of sadness. I think slightly too convenient to die of sadness on the day that your rival returns to London. So he died on the 21st of May, 1471. And every year since 1923, Eton and King's College representatives have come into the Tower to place lilies and roses at the place where, by tradition, he died. Although I would argue possibly not actually where he really did die.
Oh, really?
Because at the time Henry died, the Wakefield Tower just wasn't a sensible place to put a king you were trying to keep in prison. It was like a through route, really, into other parts of the tower. It was stuffed with a load of other things in the way the tower, quite fascinatingly, throughout its history, they just put things in a cupboard and leave it there, and they go, oh, I think the Queen's arriving tomorrow. We should move this giant crossbow we've put in her bedroom.
This old corpse.
Yeah, exactly. This old thing. So I suspect Henry was actually kept a bit further inside the tower. And having done some research into it, I couldn't find any evidence for the Wakefield Tower being the place that he was named as dying until essentially the 19th century.
There's a rich history in this country of doing in monarchs and royalty. And the big concern is not leaving a mark on the body. As you say, it's almost like people in the Middle Ages would have gone, well, it is quite convenient, but there's no marks on the body, so I suppose it's all fine. So obviously there's Richard II was starved to death, and the princes in the Tower were smothered, and Edward II, well, there's varying accounts of what happened to him. But do we know how Henry died?
We don't know. What's intriguing, I think, is that there is a description by a chronicler writing pretty close to the time this happened, who describes Henry as being transported through the streets open visage, so with his face on display to people, and that the body bled twice, in fact. And some people have said, well, it couldn't have bled so long after he died, but I consulted a forensic archaeologist who said that definitely it could, because of the way you move bodies. If there was any sort of hole that might not have been revealed, I mean, if his face is on display, the rest of him presumably is not, conveniently covering any other signs of trauma that might have been there in the body, then if you move the body at certain times, like, you know, onto a funeral bier or something.
You brought that to life, you moved the microphone.
Yeah, I know. It was the power of Henry returned. yes, that at those moments, it could indeed, the body could have bled. So I think that's fairly telling. I think he probably was stabbed. That seems quite likely. When his body was exhumed in 1911, they did find that his body was very broken up, although it's tricky to be certain what had caused that, because it had been moved from one coffin to another coffin after he was dead. But certainly parts of his head were, the skull were damaged.
I mean, there are worse ways to go. Poker up the bum, which brings to mind.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if we're doing the league table of ways I'd like to be killed as a medieval king, then I suppose it's not that bad. What can we expect from your book? I pre-ordered it today.
Oh, thank you very much.
What can I expect when it drops into my inbox on the 7th of March?
You can expect a very large book.
Okay.
That's very gold. And also, as I said, to find Henry VI as a human being, not as a symbol of kingship, not as someone just who is infallibly weak, not as someone who was, and I'm using air quotes here, just a mad king, but someone who changed throughout the course of his life, who evolved. And one of the great tragedies of him, I think, is that there was hope that he could change as a king. Mm. And he never got to do that.
Well worth revisiting Henry VI, and no better way than to do it with Shadow King, The Life and Death of Henry VI, which is out in the UK on the 7th of March. Lauren Johnson, thank you very much.
Thank you for having
thank
me.
Thank you.
Cheers.
It's everybody's favourite part of the show. It's time for the poorly researched idiom that nobody asked for. Gemma, how do you feel this week? Are you excited?
I am always excited. Always.
You
I'm also worried.
Gemma does tend to sort of have... Do you always feel like you're quite positive before the idiom and you look for the positives in it?
I do. I really, really try.
Okay. Gemma, Lauren, are you aware of the term sleep tight?
Yes.
Yes. Mm. Meaning someone telling someone to sleep well. Mm. Sleep tight, for those of you listening at home. One possible origin of this phrase dates back to when mattresses were supported by ropes. Sleeping tight meant sleeping with the ropes pulled tight, which would provide a well-sprung bed. That's my... Lauren, are you nodding because that's right?
I have heard that before.
Oh, yeah. Hello.
It's not the first time I've heard that one.
I can't believe it.
This is a watershed moment on the Viral History Podcast. My idiom might be correct.
When did people sleep with mattresses tied to ropes, or did you not?
We don't have an era.
Right, okay.
Medieval times they did.
Okay.
Yeah, you can see some reconstructed medieval beds at various different heritage sites, Tower of London, Dover Castle.
Yeah, Gemma.
whatever.
And essentially, you know, you've got like the four-post bed with the four posts on it, and there's a kind of base frame there, and then underneath is the bit where the ropes would hang and the mattresses would go on top of that.
Oh,
so it'd be almost
I was picturing it sort of like hanging from the ceiling.
Oh, yeah, that would... I don't think they did. Maybe
like
on
a
ships.
Giant swing.
Let's focus on what's important here, and that's that my idea might be right. For the first time, I'm so happy. I can't stop smiling. Lauren, thank you so much.
It means we can keep it in the show.
Yeah.
it means we can use it this week. Right, every week we run a competition. Now, all you need to do to be in with a chance of winning the competition is to send us your review. Our favourite review will win the competition. Simple. But because we are unsure as to how to prove your identity, please take a screenshot of your review and send it to Viral History on Twitter at @viral_history. That's it. We've done our part, Gemma. We've done our best to try and work out.
I'm washing my hands of it.
I'm stepping back from it. I'm blaming it on producer Dom. He's in charge of all competition and prizes and all legal inquiries. Go straight to Dom.
We'll publish his personal phone number later.
This week's prize is a copy of Lauren's book, Shadow King, The Life and Death of Henry VI. So to be in with a chance of winning it, just send us a screenshot of your review on Twitter @viral_history, and our favourite will be in with a chance of winning. Gemma, what sort of reviews have the best chance of winning?
Five-star reviews.
Five-star reviews.
That's not at all leading.
Absolutely right. And do keep your eye on the Viral History Twitter feed on Tuesday, 12th of March, so you can see who the winner is. I'm Lauren Johnson. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
It's been lovely.
Gemma, pleasure as always. If you want to get in touch, it's really easy. Twitter is @viral_history, Instagram @viralhistory, Facebook and YouTube are quite simply Viral History, and info@viral-history.com is the email address. It's the Viral History Podcast. Thanks for listening.